maybe a couple years after I started flying. I've been flying the F-22 for about 6.5 years. So a couple years after I started flying, I noticed certain things I never felt after flying. I flew the F-16 for 6 years and other military fighters for years before that. Things I never felt flying those jets.
Like?
A lot of coughing after flying, kind of dry, unproductive coughing, the inability to take a full breath or even sneeze or cough, because when you try and inhale to do that, I can't get the air in.
Do you have trouble exercising?
I couldn't really effectively exercise to, I guess, a level that would satisfy me within 12 to 24 hours after flying, because I couldn't get the breath in.
It sounds like everything was surrounding the lungs, the way you described
well,
it.
Well, that was the initial symptom I presented. Other things, laying down for bed at night after flying and getting just the spinning room feeling, dizziness, tumbling, vertigo kind of stuff.
Did you have any headaches?
Absolutely. Deep throbbing kind of in the middle of my head, not like forehead, temple stress stuff, just like kind of unexplained.
Headache.
Yeah.
What about your memory? Do you have any memory
problems? Yeah, I liken it to, I call it my fuzzy feeling or fogginess in the head. And I know my family noticed it as well, but just inability to have short-term memory recall and feeling like I've just left a concert kind of feeling in the head.
So how did you discover that that other pilots were having what you were having?
Amongst fighter pilots, we're kind of shy about talking about personal medical issues, either fears of getting grounded or machismo or whatever you want to call it. In general, you just don't talk about that stuff. The cough was evident. Everyone talked about that. But once words started coming out of other symptoms, guys would empathize and say, yeah, yes. And the F-22 community is small.
Yeah, so we
know each other, yes.
So just to tie your job and my job together a little bit, obviously we're both in the media, we're both working with the military, but I think have a little bit different viewpoints. You know, from the pop culture end, everyone seems to love a good military movie, tons of support, you know, everyone wants to cheer on the good guys. And, you know, from where I stand, you know, covering particularly the budget process, I think there is a lot of support for the military, but perhaps not so much understanding. You know, when the rubber hits the road and money gets a little bit tight, the number of times I hear, oh, well, if we just stop buying F-35s, then we'll have enough money for this other priority. And certainly not to call anyone's support into question, but perhaps understanding. So that's where I wanted to start this conversation. You know, you are looking to portray the military in its entirety as clearly and as accurately as possible for public consumption. And I just wonder if you worry that there's still a divide between what people see in your line of work and sort of, you know, a more cheery version versus, you know, the understanding that has to happen in sort of the news side of things.
Well, sure. Look, Megan, of course there's a divide. And if budget meetings and robbing Peter to pay Paul among programs were at all interesting, we'd make movies about that. But it's not. It sucks. And it's boring. Lord knows you know that. So we focus on the other end of it. But in so doing, in the business of saying, all right, now the budget hassle is over, and here's what it bought, and here's what we can do, and here's what we have done, and so on and so forth, I think in large measure we bring an understanding to the audience that whatever that budget problem was worth it, and this is what we get out of it. At least I hope that's part of the message that comes across in some of the films that we do.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to Clandestine. I'm Tom Secker, coming to you from the Spy Culture Headquarters, and this is episode 256, Military Industrial Product Placement. One thing the Pentagon love to do is showcase absurdly costly technologies to the public. This military product placement helps justify exorbitant budgets and show off American exceptionalism and superiority. The problem is that most of this crap doesn't work. In this episode, we look at the cinematic and real-life histories of some major military tech. The F-35 fighter bomber, the V-22 helicopter that turns into a plane, and the littoral combat ship, and how Hollywood helps the military continue to buy failed technologies at vast prices. This is a topic I have wanted to discuss for some time, because it's a story of government waste, propaganda, and political hypocrisy. While we usually look at the Hollywood perception management around either specific events or general policies, we've never discussed this in depth before, so it's about time we did. The US military has, by far, the largest military budget on the planet. While both China and Russia have invested billions in so-called modernization programs for their own militaries in recent years, the US remains way out in front, and has been so far out in front for so long that the cumulative effect is by far the most expensive military that has ever existed. For fiscal year 2024, the Pentagon is seeking a budget of $824 billion out of an overall national security budget of $886 billion. That's higher than the total GDP of all but the top 19 countries, the 20th being Switzerland. Everyone from Switzerland down through Taiwan, Vietnam, Iran, Cuba, Ghana, all the way down to the little Pacific Island nations generate less overall money as a country than the US spends on supposedly protecting itself and its interests. Put another way, the total GDP of both Malaysia and Hong Kong together is about the same as the DoD will spend over the next year. How does this happen? How does a country with 4.25% of the world's population spend more on weapons and other military expenditure than the next dozen or so countries combined? On the military spending per capita scale, the US is so far out in front, it is absurd. Well, there are several answers. Over the last century and a half, the US has built a near-global empire, having started out as a bunch of colonies stitched together by fairly tenuous agreements into some kind of federal republic. The annexation of Hawaii, the land grab known as the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II. These and the domestic expansion through annexing parts of Mexico and buying Alaska off the Russians saw the US expand dramatically in geographical territory, geopolitical reach, the ability to project military power, the ability to spy on everyone, and, of course, the economy. But would they have been able to do this without spending enormous sums on developing artillery, then explosives, then chemical weapons, then submarines and planes and aircraft carriers, so on and so forth, all the way up to the weapons and systems we're going to look at today? I think not. Once again, capitalism, empire, technocracy, and militarism are in a mutually reinforcing dynamic. What is often ignored, however, is the role that propaganda and military-industrial product placement have played in the rise of the US empire. In particular, the invention of cinema, the most effective form of war propaganda, and the US dominion over the world movie industry is a key factor. As I have cited before, there are US military-supported movies from the 1900s, back in the single-reel silent film era, before Hollywood even existed, or at least was called Hollywood. As soon as the movie industry got going, the government jumped in and demanded they make propaganda. First to help get the public to support America's entry into World War I, and then to maintain their involvement. In 1916, Woodrow Wilson was re-elected as president, promising neutrality, that he would help keep America out of the wars in Europe and Mexico. But he did an about-face, and Hollywood helped sell this national betrayal to the public. Indeed, they did so well that they started getting directives from the Creel Committee and elsewhere telling them to tone it down, because all of the demonization of the Germans was making it harder to reach a peace agreement. Hollywood helped prolong World War I. In the early 20s, hardly anyone made war films, at least in America, due to a widely perceived war fatigue. In the mid-1920s, as I outlined in my History of War Films episode, this changed, and by 1927 we got Wings, the Top Gun of its day. Wings broke ground in many respects. It was the first movie to win the Best Picture Oscar, it was the first movie to feature combat aircraft, it was the first to make use of product placement, Hershey's chocolate bars, in case you're wondering. It was also the first to have a soundtrack of sound effects alongside the film reel, though it was still exhibited in what was the style at the time, with a live orchestra playing the music in the theatre while the movie showed on screen. Still, it was a step halfway out of silent films and into full-colour talkies. The movie also had massive military support, entirely for free, from the US Army Air Service. As the database notes, first Academy Award for Best Picture, which sets standard of cooperation for all services. Army and Army Air Corps provided assistance in Texas for 9 months, including use of virtually entire complement of airplanes. Shot on a budget of around $2 million, a lot for 1927, it made use of hundreds of pilots and uniformed extras, many dozens of aircraft, and was shot largely on base. The director was William Wellman, himself a pilot in World War I, and though they had no end of accidents, injured people, damaged planes, and apparently one death of a pilot, the film was completed and is spectacular for its age. As Seward observed, Wellman's own experiences, the advice of his military technical advisor, and the Army's men and equipment created an epic film that won the first Best Picture Oscar. More than that, it conveyed the excitement of war in the air, which was to help the Air Force in its recruiting and in obtaining congressional appropriations. Given the expensive nature of this new war-fighting technology, planes, how do you sell it to the public? By making a movie that grossly exaggerates the role of the US Army Air Service in World War I, of course. So that's what Wellman did, having to develop new filming techniques to actually capture the motions of the planes in dramatic fashion. People talk about Top Gun as though the aerial photography is amazing, but to be honest, a lot of it is just planes against a blue sky. You don't really get a sense of high speed from many of those shots. This is the problem Wellman faced. A horse or a car moving on the ground has visual points of reference that enable the eye to see how fast they are going. But up in the air, it's just sky and clouds. So it took them a couple of months of shooting on Wings before they were able to get useful footage that conveyed the speed and dynamism of the planes. The result is a great advert not only for the air service, but for planes as military vehicles. So we have the first corporate product placement being matched by the first military industrial product placement. All in a fairly shallow movie, with some romance elements and also a bit where one of the pilots shoots down his friend who is flying about in a German plane. You can really see where they ripped off a lot of Top Gun from when you watch Wings. rather than go through the whole history, through the first motion picture unit and the Office of War Information, the bouncing bomb in Dam Busters, the use of the Skyhook in Thunderball and the Green Berets, and other World War II and Cold War examples, I thought we'd pick up on some of the more recent versions of this. Michael Bay is the best case study, because more than half of his major films have had DoD support, and he graduated into directing features from making car adverts for TV. Literally, he just replaced a Lexus with a C-130 and kept the cameras rolling. Obviously, there's Armageddon, which Bay claims is the first film where anyone shot a B-2 stealth bomber. As far as I know, this is accurate. While the B-2 appears in Independence Day, it is CGI. These days you can fully 3D scan an aircraft and replicate it digitally quite easily and very accurately, but back in the 1990s that technology wasn't available. I assume the Independence Day animators just pieced it together from photographs. So, the B-2 made its real debut in Armageddon. But Bay also claims to have been the first to shoot the F-22 for the first Transformers film. One of the making-of features for Transformers, called Decepticon Strike, is almost entirely about military hardware.
Which one of those do you think was a Decepticon? Maybe one, maybe none.
Decepticons are actually very fun, because they're just wicked.
It seemed to serve the story better to have military vehicles being the real theme of the Decepticons as opposed to too many tape decks or a gun or things that were clever and great in the cartoon, but a little bit unfocused for our purposes.
Michael has a pretty good relationship with DoD, and so it was kind of interesting that we're using all the military in this movie in the robot form or bad guys.
I'll be honest, I had to sort of pitch this to my chain of command in that there's Air Force aircraft as bad guys.
Because of Michael's relationships in the past and, you know, Armageddon and other films he's done, the thought was that Dealey would get the help of the armed forces in the end.
You see, the Air Force cameraman, I keep trying to tell him, turn, let me show you. Trying to change his smile. See, he's a little rigid. Everything's like this. He looks like that, walks like that. It's rigid. Oh, look, oh, now he's got a little MTV style going. See? By lunch, he's got a little MTV style going.
And he loves the military. He knows how to portray the military to make us look good, and so it seemed like a win-win. And people love bad guys. The fact is, I mean, what's cooler than Darth Vader?
I've always been like some of the first to shoot military hardware. And Armageddon, I was the first to shoot the B-2 bomber. Then this movie was the F-22s, which are the new $130 million amazing stealth fighters.
Starscream was an F-15 Air Force jet back in the early cartoon days, and back then the F-15 in the 80s was the quickest and the fastest and the baddest thing around. Well, fast forward 25 years, the F-22 is now that aircraft.
Rolling, ready. Roll cameras, roll cameras.
Ready, and action. Good.
There we go, look at that.
What the Air Force has done in this show has shown us all of the good toys. Brandy new stuff that really hasn't even been put into the field yet.
Is there any hand signals that the crew guys in the front give? Anything you give at all? Any hand signals? All right, I want to do some hand signals. We're going to come right by you. Guys, go back to the crew.
What kind of signals do you guys give?
That aircraft is just, it's just phenomenal what it can do. There's war games they play where they'll send, you know, three or four of those things out against 20 or so current F-15, F-16s, and it's not even a contest.
Target ID.
They can fire on enemies that are beyond the curvature of the Earth. They can track and fire on things that are 270 miles away. So they can, those guys are dead before they're even within visual contact of that plane.
So it's just very fitting that Starscream, who's the, you know, the air commander and second in command, takes that form of literally the baddest weapon system in the world right now.
We have Blackout, which is a MH-53 helicopter. It's a gigantic troop transport, mean-looking helicopter.
Just looks badass, you know. Like, the Cobras are kind of slight. You know, yeah, they carry a lot of firepower, but as far as just looking big and menacing, the Sea Stallion was, like, the logical choice.
Yeah, I got my fire suit on, baby. I'm directing.
Ready, on, seven, six, five, four.
I can't think of anything remotely this huge that the Air Force has been involved with, not only in, you know, screen time, but just the amount of aircraft and people and shooting on bases and everything that we've done.
What we're going to want to do is we want to stack you guys up. So with long lens, we'll make you look very close. You know what I'm saying? So we'll put you kind of like this to each other. You know, like put it over there and that a little bit. We're stacked up with the sun.
Coming over the tower.
About 300.
The tower is actually a good place to come.
Airbus, that's 312. Do you want airplane mode or conversion mode on this?
Left. Correction, right. Right. To me. Come on. Right, right, right. To me. Right, right.
Oh, yeah, baby. Right in the golden glow.
Lower, lower, lower.
Yeah. Bring him down.
Send him
lower.
Away. Turn him around. Turn him around.
Bring
turn
him
around.
Down. Another pass. Another pass. Take it around.
Well, I was also the first to use the Ospreys, which are for extracting soldiers. It's kind of like a helicopter plane. It's like these gigantic helicopter blades. Looks very dangerous, if you ask me. And they actually rotate down and become gigantic propellers that angle forward and can go about 300-something miles an hour. Warthogs were a very interesting kind of plane because it's kind of eerie because they get very low and they're just got this whine to it.
Are they coming, Josh? Good. Okay, come higher up. Come higher up. Right now, right now, guys.
And that's got a lethal cannon on it. You know, it's a creepy plane. If you're on the ground, you don't want to be there if it's shooting at you. The military gave us the use of the Spooky, which is a C-130, specially equipped, like 18 guns. It's a thing they use to shoot Taliban in Afghanistan. It's a vicious old plane, but it's very lethal.
The 49th Fighter Wing at Holloman is the home of the stealth fighter, the F-117 Nighthawk.
Well, they scrambled the stealth fighter, like 50 of them staged there, so we had them all rolling around, and it was crazy.
It's still a very sensitive aircraft. The technology that is involved with it is still very top secret.
I don't want you filming from that angle, please.
We had to just basically make sure that certain protocols were kept in mind, that you couldn't film it that way, you couldn't get close to it this way. And once again, the production bent over backwards to make sure that they followed all the rules.
Our tax dollars happily at work.
One of the things that a lot of people don't understand, that all military support is on a cost basis. This costs the taxpayer absolutely nothing.
The movie pays for any costs of the aircraft and personnel that cannot otherwise be used in training missions.
If a helicopter is flying and it costs X number of dollars per hour to fly that helicopter, the production company reimburses it.
Technology that the government allowed us to be around and some of the tools they allowed us to use, you wouldn't be able to get anywhere else in the world.
These are target practice tanks. What they do is, this one is a mock-up of a fake foreign tank, so the targeting systems can pick out friend or foe.
Uh-huh.
When they shoot them in the missile test range.
At Holloman, they have what's known as a tank graveyard, and there's probably 1,000 tanks and self-propelled artillery pieces and stuff like that. And the first time I took Michael in there, he was like a kid at Christmas. It was like, can I have that? Can I have that? Can I burn that? Can I blow that up? You know? Absolutely. Anything you want.
Which one do you like the least?
The least?
Because,
you want to burn it?
No. Something a little more wicked.
However, Bay is wrong. The F-22 had already appeared on screen a few years before, in Ang Lee's Hulk. After the Hulk escapes from the desert facility and goes running off across Nevada towards Southern California, the Marine Corps notes say, "Recommend F-22s streak past, reporting the Hulk's location to Ross, who in turn reports up his chain of command that the Hulk is entering a populated area, but has so far not appeared to be dangerous unless provoked. Still, it's imperative to be prepared. When the incident with the hang glider takes place, Ross wonders if the Hulk was trying to avoid an accident or attack the plane, but he has an idea about how to subdue the Hulk, who has climbed on top of the fighter. When you watch the film, it more or less plays out as the military pitched it. The F-22 is front and center in the pursuit of the Hulk. And this was not the only time they recommended using specific technologies that they wanted to show off. Emails from Strub's office show how the DoD wanted the filmmakers to incorporate VMADs, vehicle-mounted area denial systems, essentially Humvees with radar dish-looking things on them that emit microwaves used to attack living things. They're now in use by metropolitan police departments against protesters and the like, but back in the early 2000s, they were just a military tech. The email begins, "Well, I have some free time, so here goes. Get ready for some cool toys." Before outlining a whole sequence in which the military confront the Hulk, they try tear gas and firing nets at him, but this just pisses him off, and he throws a car at them, justifying them amping up the weaponry. Then they roll out the VMADs and burn the Hulk with millimeter waves. The email goes on. "That stops him. Now to drive him. Riot troops using rubber bullets, 203 rounds, and beanbag rounds literally drive him towards a side street, a steep hill. Here, he hits the slippery foam, will look great in slow-mo. Eventually, he slides down the hill and into the high-tech vehicle barrier system, C-PICS. Once entangled, troops can hit him with tasers till he is unconscious or subdued. Hulk is captured, and military looks great. Also can add a good 15 minutes of screen time. So what do you think?" This suggested idea wasn't used for the 2003 Hulk, but a very similar sequence, including the VMADS technology, does appear in the 2008 Incredible Hulk, which was supported by the Canadian, but not the US military. Even when your script is too radical for DoD support, you can still find someone to place their hardware into your film.
Where are the 50 cal? Move your asses!
Follow me.
Returning to Transformers, the Air Force and other military product placement was on a scale not seen since epics like The Longest Day and Wings. All the way back in December 2005, they were meeting with Bay to discuss the story, before the draft script had even been completed. An ELO report says, "We discussed several opportunities to highlight Air Force personnel, operations, and equipment." Over the following months, the Air Force arranged for scouting trips to several military bases, and listed the aircraft that Bay, producer Ian Bryce, and others had seen. Then, in May, an update listed all of the air-to-air aircraft requests, including MH-53s, CV-22s, a C-130, F-117s, an A-10 Thunderbolt, so on and so on. Entries in the Army and Marine Corps ELO reports on the early Transformers films do the same, outline all the different bits of military hardware they were going to show off. The Army entries on Transformers 3, for example, keep saying, "It will give us the opportunity to showcase the bravery and values of our soldiers and the excellent technology of today's Army to a global audience in an apolitical blockbuster." Getting back to the first Transformers movie, as shooting began, there was another update. First day of flying ops at Holloman began Thursday. The scenes filmed included A-10 aircraft from Pope Air Force Base and an AC-130 gunship Hurlburt Air Force Base. Two CV-22 from Kirtland will fly today, May 26. In all, 16 US Air Force and more than 90 aircrew and maintenance personnel will be participating in filming of the movie at Holloman for several days over the next 2 weeks. The V-22 Osprey, also known as the Transformer due to its ability to convert from a vertical takeoff helicopter-type craft into a rapidly forward-moving plane-type craft, appears a lot in both the documents and in films. It's the aircraft used to fly the Black Ops team into the fictional Latin American country in Suicide Squad. It appears in the A-Team movie and Battle Los Angeles, also in War Dogs, Terminator Salvation, and Sicario, Day of the Soldado, and in CGI form in two of the MonsterVerse films. The Air Force version is known as the CV-22, while the Marine Corps version is the MV-22. But it's the same aircraft underneath. And it's not got a great record. So bad, in fact, that it has been grounded on several occasions because it keeps crashing. An article from August 2022 by the Project on Government Oversight details how the Air Force decided to ground their entire fleet of V-22s due to its safety record, but the Marine Corps keep on using them. Mark Thompson's piece references other sources, detailing how Dick Cheney tried four times to get rid of the Osprey, a program that had cost $20 billion by that point and cost over $35 billion in total. While crashes have claimed the lives of dozens, the Marine Corps are pressing on, simply retraining their pilots, supposedly, to deal with the clutch issues and other quirks of the aircraft.
That breaking news out of Imperial County, where a military aircraft crashed. The U.S. Marine officials confirmed to us it was a V-22 Osprey. Here's a look at where that crash happened. The plane went down near Glamis. That's on Coachella Canal Road off the 78. Now, this is video just into our newsroom of the area shortly after the crash. From a distance, you can nearly see some of the black smoke rising. Military and civilian first responders are on site. So far, we have no confirmed reports on what happened to the crew members on board or how many were on board. We do have a crew heading to that area in hopes of learning more information.
Back in 2000, A crash in Arizona killed 16 Marines and was blamed on pilot error. Nonetheless, the MV-22s were temporarily grounded pending investigation. The file on The Sum of All Fears includes an email from this time from Major Thomas Johnson to Captain Matt Morgan at the ELO, saying, "Captain Morgan, for your information, General Sattler called this morning. Apparently Don B. mentioned something to CMC, that's the Commandant of the Marine Corps, about using an MV-22 in a JAG episode. Groan, here we go again. CMC loves the idea, hence the hard sell to All Fears. But of course, the Ospreys are hard down at the moment. As you will most likely inherit this project, just keep in mind that we've been pretty much given the keys to the aircraft, providing they've been deemed airworthy at the time they are required by the production company. The script is a great read, except for the CIA assassination at the end, and the Army warrant officer who carries the football. I thought this guy was usually a Marine major. Just a guess. Anyway, I'll put the script in your office. It's a pretty entertaining read." Evidently, the Commandant of the Marine Corps was trying to sell the idea of using the MV-22 in The Sum of All Fears, even though they were grounded because of the Arizona crash and another around the same time. Or perhaps because they were grounded and in need of a PR boost. Being highlighted in a major Tom Clancy movie starring President Morgan Freeman and Ben Affleck does a lot to repair the helicopter's image, if not its flight performance. In 2016, the Marine Corps finally admitted that the Arizona crash was not caused by pilot error, but by the aircraft itself failing. Widows and other bereaved loved ones of the Marines who died had pushed for over a decade to get the Corps to admit this, showing just how sensitive they are about the V-22 issue, hence their desire to place it into movies and TV. Indeed, as I'm writing this, there's a story doing the rounds in news media about a crash in Melville Island, Australia, which killed 3 Marines and seriously injured 5 others. The aircraft still isn't being grounded, despite its death toll simply from crashes being up to 54 people.
The urgent search for answers after 3 U.S. Marines are killed in an Osprey crash. At least 5 others were seriously injured during a routine training mission in Australia. This is just the latest in a series of recent crashes involving the aircraft, renewing new questions about its safety. Here's ABC's Faith Abube.
Tonight, an urgent investigation into what caused an Osprey aircraft to crash on Australia's Melville Island, killing at least 3 U.S. Marines, 23 troops on board, at least 5 others flown to the hospital in serious condition.
Our focus as a government and as the Department of Defense is very much on incident response and on making sure that every support and assistance is given at this difficult time.
Military officials say the crash happened at 9:30 a.m. local time during a 12-day routine training, which has since been paused. It was in support of an operation involving military personnel from 5 countries, but only American troops were involved in the deadly crash. The Osprey, which flies like a plane and lands like a helicopter, has a patchy safety record. 16 people have died in 5 other crashes involving the military aircraft since 2012. Including 2 in this fiery crash in Hawaii in 2015. And just last month, a military investigation found that 5 Marines died in an Osprey crash in California last year due to, quote, a catastrophic, unpreventable, and unanticipated mechanical failure when a problem with a clutch caused right engine failure, sending the aircraft out of control.
This is the second fatal accident in just a few days for the Marine Corps. It may be time to stop, take a step back, and make sure that Marine Corps is doing everything it needs to do to fly safely.
Faith joins us now live from Washington. Faith, you're learning tonight that there's a black box on that aircraft, which could help the Marine Corps determine what caused this crash fairly quickly.
Yeah, Rachel, not only that, but our military analyst also says since there were survivors in this crash, it suggests a mishap either during takeoff or landing, meaning those surviving service members should be able to help investigators figure out whether this was a mechanical problem or human error. Rachel.
All right, Faith, thank you.
Getting back to the F-22, it's a similar story. A mysterious crash in Alaska in 2010 killed one pilot. Another crash in 2020 was a combination of the plane misbehaving and the guys who had washed it leaving a piece of tape stuck on an outlet that no one spotted before it was sent up into the air. The 2020 incident was hushed up, with the Air Force not following procedure and convening an accident investigation board because of operational security concerns. It was one of several incidents involving the 325th Fighter Wing, with Air Force Times reporting, "Nearly half of the 9 Class A and B F-22 mishaps in fiscal 2020 occurred at the 325th Fighter Wing, including one that destroyed a fighter jet. Since fiscal 2018, Raptors across the service have seen at least 16 Class A accidents, one more than the 15 that had occurred over the 18 years prior, according to Air Force Safety Center data. Class A mishaps cost at least $2 million, involve a destroyed aircraft, or cause death or permanent and total disability. Class B mishaps are those that cost between $500,000 and $2 million, lead to a permanent partial disability, or cause inpatient hospitalization of at least 3 people." I'm sure you can see how the F-22 used to have a fairly decent record, but in recent years the number of mishaps is spiralling drastically. So, let's go back to Transformers, and an article from 2009 on Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, which came out at a time that the F-22 was in danger of being cancelled entirely, at least according to the rhetoric coming out of the Obama White House. It quotes Brian McGarry, a U.S. Air Force captain who serves as deputy director for the Air Force Entertainment Liaison Office in Los Angeles, saying, "It's the first feature opportunity for showing an F-22 dropping a JDAM, guided bomb." Then, the article notes how the House Armed Services Committee had just voted to order 12 new F-22s, which cost around $200 million each. 8 more than Gates had asked for in his request to the committee. When you see a wide-angle shot of F-22s or hear the real sound of them flying by or rolling in on a target, there's no substitute, McGarry added. The article details how he helped coordinate Air Force resources with the wish lists of Transformers filmmakers, such as timing F-16 training flights with the movie's shooting schedule. For arrangements outside the usual military training, filmmakers paid the hourly operating cost of the Air Force equipment. Just as an aside, once again they're moving training exercises around to fit in with the movie shooting schedules, which they aren't supposed to do, because it saves the filmmakers money and interferes with said training schedules. But I guess when your film helps promote all of this expensive hardware and cover up for the fact it keeps crashing and killing people, moving a few exercises around on the calendar is a small price for the DoD to pay. The most expensive waste of money in government history is the F-35, an aircraft that was supposed to be a fighter bomber that was adaptable enough to be used by all branches of the US military, a true joint strike fighter. It first appeared in a movie in CGI form in Superman Returns, not a film that appears to be military supported. The plane only performs a simple escort role in a brief sequence. A year later, and it was back, in Live Free or Die Hard, where it chases John McClane because the military have been tricked into thinking he's a terrorist. The plane destroys an entire motorway, then another one, all while missing its target, McClane, who is driving a big truck like in Terminator 2. The plane ends up crashing, with the pilot ejecting.
In 2011's Green Lantern, our protagonist starts out as an F-35 test pilot, but during an exercise where he's battling two drones, he flies up to high altitude, his engine stalls, and he bails out. So far, the cinematic record of the F-35 is not great. Then, in the first Avengers film, it battles the Hulk and he leaps out from the flying aircraft carrier onto the plane, not unlike the scene in the 2003 Hulk suggested by the Marine Corps ELO. Strub tried to distance himself from this by saying that the F-35 wasn't real, it was digitally inserted by the studio, as though people thought that scene really happened, where the Hulk starts smashing up the plane in midair. Bizarrely, the DoD then made a bit of a fuss about the F-35's official debut in Man of Steel the following year, when it appears in the background in one scene. Strub called it a target of opportunity. They also insisted the F-35 appear in CGI form in the sequence where they take on General Zod's forces. The script notes say, page 106, scene 202 and elsewhere, downtown Metropolis. We assume that the point of this, and scene 235 on page 118, is to portray, via CGI, the heroic sacrifices of fighter pilots to divert the Kryptonians from the C-17, because the destructive capability of the Kryptonians has already been amply demonstrated. If so, these must all be Air Force fighter aircraft, F-35 or otherwise. Hence, the bit in Man of Steel where an Air Force pilot says, "A good death is its own reward," before doing a kamikaze crash into the big alien machine, 9/11 style. In this film where the skyscrapers of Metropolis are destroyed, crumbling to the ground, 9/11 style. Were they trying to say... No, never mind.
Is its own reward.
Why does this Man of Steel story amuse me so much? Because they couldn't actually film the damn thing flying for real. They could make it fly with CGI, but the real ones had to be filmed on the ground. The F-35 barely worked in 2012, even though it was supposed to be fully operational and combat ready by that point. It had already appeared in several films where it proved overly destructive, impossible to control, and/or blew up. All of which are somewhat reflective of its operational record up until that point. Then, Man of Steel came along and now they finally had what they wanted, a possible portrait of the F-35 in combat, against aliens. But because the damn thing wasn't flying properly, they had to do that bit with CGI, while only being able to show the real ones being towed around, because in 2012, the world's most expensive plane couldn't do a lot more than that.
Parts flying everywhere, parts of the wings, parts of the cockpit, and then just fire.
Our jets are very reliable. Our maintenance is incredible. The jets are very safe for us to fly, so these things don't happen very often.
A chaotic scene in Ogden tonight after an F-35 military jet crashed at the end of the runway at Hill Air Force Base.
The 388th Fighter Wing confirming the pilot was able to eject from that jet before it slammed into the ground. They say that the plane went down on the north end of that runway. Flames, smoke, they're visible for miles around the site of the crash.
The pilot ejected and landed in a nearby neighborhood. Ashley Moser talked with the people who saw it. We're going to hear from them in just a few minutes.
Why is something that doesn't work so damn expensive? The 2001 estimate for the full cost of the F-35 program was $233 billion. But by 2019, it had ballooned to $397.8 billion and has continued to grow since. The engines don't work properly, so much so that the DoD has taken to listing the aircraft and engines separately in its acquisition reports. The engine is so weak that from the off there was an agreement that the F-35 could be out of commission 5 times more often than other military aircraft. Such was Pratt & Whitney's inability to actually build an engine capable of reliably flying the plane. The problem is so drastic that a British Navy F-35 simply fell off the end of an aircraft carrier in late 2021 without ever getting airborne. The engine appears to just give up, the pilot ejects, and the plane falls into the Mediterranean. There have been crashes at Hill Air Force Base in Utah, Fort Worth in Texas, another one in Carolina, and a mysterious one in the Pacific where a Japanese F-35 sent no distress signal, the pilot attempted no rescue maneuver. It seems to have just cut out and plummeted into the ocean. The Japanese Defense Ministry blamed the pilot, who of course died in the crash. Another one happened at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, which due to pilot survival couldn't be blamed on his error, so they had to find the real reasons. This included a malfunctioning oxygen supply, fairly important for pilots, a malfunctioning head-mounted display, not unlike in Iron Man, and the flight controls were unresponsive. Yet another happened on board the USS Carl Vinson, the ship used to film parts of Top Gun and also used to bury Osama bin Laden, allegedly. 7 people were injured during a ramp strike on the deck of the ship. The pilot ejected relatively safely, and the plane skidded off into the ocean. It was eventually recovered from a depth of around 12,000 feet at the bottom of the South China Sea. Because we couldn't let the Chinese or Russians get their hands on this completely useless piece of utter shite. They might get it working, and then where would we be?
The current fleet of small surface combatants, which right now is all littoral combat ships, are focused mission ships with a single mission in mind. That brings some real capability in the littorals where a large carrier battle group can't get to.
People ask me about littoral combat ship. Is it a new cruiser or destroyer? Actually, it's neither. It's an entirely new category of warship. The carriers, cruisers, and destroyers are more like desktop computers, whereas an LCS is more like a smartphone. This ship is designed to defeat global challenges in the littoral environment.
LCS offers the perfect recipe for speed to capability because it has modularity, open architecture, and common U.S. Navy systems.
LCS can access places that our other ships can't go, but then because the LCS is a node on the network, it can send that information back to those multi-mission ships in order for them to have that data in their part of the fight.
The topside of LCS has 3 flexible weapon spaces. As technology evolves and threats change, these spaces can accommodate new capabilities, such as vertical launching systems or directed energy weapons. This flexibility allows the U.S. Navy to keep pace with technology and threats.
About 40% of the ship is reconfigurable space. So when we bring an asset in, we have controlled interfaces where we can plug those in to not only provide information to our network, but our network to provide information to it.
What's next for LCS is upgrades to lethality and survivability. It means LCS will have weapons that can outrange adversary weapons, It also means LCS will have better situational awareness and more options to outmaneuver a threat. Lethality and survivability upgrades are already underway. The ship's computing infrastructure is getting complete cyber upgrade. Over-the-horizon missiles are being installed on the front of the ship, and electronic warfare systems are being removed and replaced with next-gen systems that enhance situational awareness and improve the ship's self-defense capabilities.
I think a lot of people are going to fall in love with the capability it brings to the fleet, especially when we get them out there in numbers. I think it's going to be fantastic. Can't wait.
Indeed, the Navy's littoral combat ship is in some ways their F-35 or V-22, in that they keep pushing it on Hollywood, but it is beset by scandals and problems. In March this year, three men at Austal USA, a company that builds the LCS, were indicted for massive fraud. But that is just the tip of the iceberg. Originally, contracts were awarded to General Dynamics and Lockheed Martin to come up with designs for the ship, with the idea being to amalgamate the designs and then award the building contract separately. Instead, the Navy decided to go with both designs and get 10 copies of each version. Bear in mind, these things cost around $500 million each. The problems are quite fundamental. The Lockheed version doesn't steer straight. Or, as one Navy document put it, ship is inherently directionally unstable. Constant equipment failures, the occasional ship-wide power outage, cracks in the hulls letting water in, and in other parts of the structure, engine failures, rampant corrosion, failure of seals leading to more water coming in. It's had some issues during testing. A DoD assessment said that the LCS was not expected to be survivable in a hostile combat environment, i.e., if we send this thing into a war, everyone on board is going to die. By 2015, serious design flaws had emerged, and the response was to spend an extra $75 million per ship to retrofit and up-armour them to compensate for these flaws. The ships were so useless that the Navy stopped asking for them, but Congress somehow approved more purchases. The DoD's request in 2017 asked for only one more LCS, albeit at a cost of $1.2 billion. I have no idea how those numbers are supposed to add up. In 2020, the Navy decided to decommission four of these ships, one of which had only completed a single operational deployment in 2017, and the oldest of which had only been in use since 2008. They had come to realise that their dream of a multi-mission close-to-shore ship with different modules and crews that could easily be swapped out was a miserable failure. Stuffing as many technologies into one boat as possible, without figuring the basics like piping and getting the toilets and electricity to work, proved to be as stupid as it sounds. Because of all this, the Navy have had to pitch and push the LCS onto Hollywood to mask this epic waste of national and natural resources. Their ongoing Hollywood to the Navy program, where they take people on tours of ships and submarines, had its first LCS-themed event in 2013. The senior guest was Robert Orci of Mission Impossible and Star Trek fame. The same year, they met with Bob Crasser, who was planning an IMAX movie around naval vessels, and they recommended changing his premise to LCS, DDG-1000, and F-35s. You see how this works. Someone comes in with an idea, they try to inject the technologies they want to promote. In early 2014, the Secretary of the Navy paid a visit, and the ELO reports say, successful SECNAV visit and key leader engagements with executives from NCIS, CBS execs, and Nautilus, Godzilla, Legendary Pigs. SECNAV talking points with NCIS execs include future episode development that highlights SAPR adjudication, that's sexual assault, demonstration of new capabilities, LCS, and females in key leadership command roles. A few months later, and they were arranging a site visit for writers and producers on NCIS to visit an LCS and talk to some of its crew. Then, the first season of The Last Ship premiered, and the LCS command were invited to the big blue carpet event. When they began discussing season 2, the LCS came up again as something both the Navy and the director wanted to include. Ditto on season 3, director/executive producer met with CO Naval Weapons Station to discuss emergent season 3 opportunities to showcase weapons loadout of destroyer/LCS. On the K2 IMAX film series Sea Power, they held conference call with director/producer to discuss progress and timeline of the show and how that fits in with Navy operational/training schedules. Re-emphasized the importance of incorporating surface and subsurface assets as a major portion of the film, including the DGG 1000 and or LCS, to comply with the production assistance agreement. When it came to Comic-Con in 2015, they had a bridge trainer for the LCS go along and provide demonstrations for the geeky writers and producers attending the event. When Discovery got in touch with a series where each episode focuses on one piece of technology and how it works, the Navy again suggested the LCS, albeit among other things. The technology didn't work at all, and by this point the Navy were rowing back on their decision to buy over 50 of these damn things, but they were still pitching it to Hollywood. There are so many examples. Jay Leno's Garage, Mega Shippers, NCIS LA, Transformers 5, Impossible Engineering, no, I'm not making that one up, Mega Marine Machines, Combat Ships 2, a PBS series called Working, no, I am not making that one up either. Even as the Navy were effectively scrapping the program, no longer buying new ships and starting to mothball existing ones, they were still helping Hollywood promote this extremely profitable lump of complex scrap. It's as though, having spent so many years proactively pushing the LCS, that they couldn't now back out and start turning down requests from the Michael Bays of this world. Having told Hollywood how great and cool and well-functioning the ship was, to go into full reverse could expose the whole scam. To round off, I want to look at one final example that, while nowhere near as expensive, is just as childish and easily mocked. It comes from a file from the US Army on Fast and Furious 8, which I obtained via a FOIA request. It relates to use of the Ripsaw vehicle, a kind of armoured car or lighter, faster tank that can be operated by remote control. True Boys with Toys stuff. Unsurprisingly, it has also appeared on Top Gear, perhaps the most military-supported TV show from the UK. The Ripsaw isn't actually being used by the US Army. It's still in testing and evaluation. But the guys who designed and built it, and have developed new versions, have made a civilian model, albeit without the weapons. As such, we can't criticise its track record. It doesn't really have one. Or its exorbitant cost, because it isn't that much. Nonetheless, I find it interesting that the Army documents make clear that they wrote the lines introducing the vehicle, and were keen to see it displayed in such a massive franchise movie. One email explains the need to have a rep on location during shooting in Iceland, and says, "The dialogue introducing the vehicle was one of the main points we wanted to get into the script, so that is extremely important to us." Then, after viewing the rough cut, "Thank you for keeping in the dialogue containing the description of the Ripsaw vehicle. That was important to us."
It's the agency garage. They call it the toy shop.
This is where we house every vehicle seized from drug dealers on the East Coast. Now, Mr. Nobody said that we're gonna have a chance at catching Dom. We're gonna have to be damn fast. Figured this would help.
We got a tank. 750 horsepower, 6.6 liter V8 Duramax engine with the M153 Crowe's remotely operated weapon station on top.
You didn't get this from drug dealers.
No, that the United States Army lent me.
See, the Army's developing machines like this that soldiers can drive from a mile away so they can stay safe and alive. But luckily, there's a backup driver's seat for those of us that like to get more hands-on.
As you can see, Ludacris praises the Ripsaw technology for keeping soldiers safe and highlights the various features, like this is some sort of automobile ad, the sort of thing that Michael Bay used to make. I can only assume the Army want the Ripsaw to become a standard vehicle rather than an experimental thing cooked up by two guys who saw a market post 9/11. Indeed, the original prototype was sent out to Iraq, though whether it was used for anything meaningful is another question. This thing has been knocking around in some form for 20 years, but it's only in the last few years it's begun making appearances in films and TV. Almost as though it was an ad hoc marketing plan cooked up by the Army's ELO. Then, there are the really dumb making-of featurettes that accompanied the movie. Note just how similar they are to the equivalent ones for Transformers.
750 horsepower with the M153 Crowe's remotely operated weapon station on top.
We got a tank.
This is heaven.
Trying to one-up the different types of vehicles that you could find in the passengers.
When I see this tank, testosterone just fills the body.
Ripsaw was something that none of us had ever seen before. And when they first brought it on the ice, we thought it was going to be problematic. We jumped it off of snowbanks. We slammed on the brakes and stood it up on its nose. We turned it around in 360 circles. It was, like, indestructible.
It's one thing to ask the Army for the Ripsaw. It's a whole nother thing to get it.
Dealing with the Department of Defense, some great people with the U.S. government put it together, and we got our Ripsaws out there.
The infamous Ripsaw is the fastest, strongest, super lightweight tank in the world right now.
It can be remote controlled.
You can put the thing on a mission and keep the person out of harm's way. It's a great military tool, and it worked out perfect for our film.
Bringing it here to Iceland is super exciting because drifting ice in a 10,000-pound, 800-horsepower, 1,200-foot-pounds of torque machine at 60 miles an hour is epic.
It's everything that my character has always wanted, all in one. When people see the movie, they'll realize why.
Okay, y'all want to play rough? Now it's my turn. I love me a tank. Yeah, baby!
What stands out here for me is that when you make a behind-the-scenes video like this about getting access to a military vehicle for use in your movie, you have to praise the DoD. In reality, it was a bit of a struggle, with emails flying around as late as December asking for final approval for shooting in early February. But this is how it works in the creative media industries. Everyone pretends to be friends. Everyone pretends everyone else is a delight to work with. And when that friend is the DoD, who can literally kill you by remote control and then make a movie glamorizing it, I do understand why these weak-ass, punk-ass, bitch-ass punks pretending to be hard men are nothing of the kind. Before I go, I do want to highlight something else. Both liberals and conservatives are equally hypocritical on this. Both sides have their people talking about government waste, government being too big, too much money being taxed off people and thrown at different things. But those same people love expensive weapons systems and love military PR, because it's good business for them too. They want all those contracts landing in their state, because higher employment equals re-election. As such, the entire system, from the movies and documentaries to the military officials to the politicians supposedly providing oversight, all are vested and complicit in this. It has been going on so long, and it has become so incestuous and mutually beneficial that I'm honestly not sure how to undo it at this point. I think factors beyond our control will be the catalyst for change, because it's already self-destructive as hell, and we keep doing it anyway. And on that slightly depressing note, I guess we should wrap this up. I hope you enjoyed this episode, a somewhat different angle on the DoD in Hollywood, and how that affects everything else, largely due to the sheer amount of money involved. This is truly an industrial dynamic that is hard to break. But I feel I did a decent job explaining how it works and why it happens, which has to be enough for one day. If you enjoyed this one, then please consider signing up to my Patreon. Podfan is now charging these stupid rates, so I'm shutting that down and looking at other crowdfunding platforms for the future. I have started an experiment in applying my investigative journalism skills to one of my other passions, football. But given the landscape in that area, it may prove to be a short-lived hobby that I use to learn a few new things to then bring back to spy culture. And I do have another plan for what to do alongside spy culture if and when I feel I've had my fun making a bit of football-themed content. So, take a look at Patreon. They do trial memberships now, so you can try before you buy, or just try and not buy. Up to you. The next episode will, I think, be a review of the Unabomber's 2015 book and the film about Ted from a couple of years ago, kind of a follow-up to my episode Was the Unabomber Right? From some time back. So, you may want to listen to that one in the meantime, or just wait until the new one is out. Until then, you've been listening to Clandestine with me, Tom Secker. So thank you for listening, and take care.